Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Talk with me, Chef Michael. You guys already know the drill. I wanted to dive in a little bit deeper into some of the complex topics around the food industry, keto, wellness, weight loss, health, all of it. But one topic that doesn't get talked about enough is how food is also entertainment. So I've brought in a really special guest, but before we get into that, I want to give you guys a little bit of information. So first of all, if you want to know more about this podcast, about this episode, or any other episode, just go to chefmichael.com/podcast, and that's chef-michael.com/podcast. You can also support this podcast by going to patreon.com. You can become a member and get tons of exclusive content, including bonus episodes. I do a reflection after my interview with each guest that is just me, you, and the camera. So join me there for those bonus episodes at patreon.com/chefmichael. You'll also get some free goodies. Last but not least, thank you so much to our sponsor, Redmond Real Salt. Guys, you gotta check this stuff out. If you don't already know about it, you should. I use it in my kitchen every single day. It is the best salt on the market, in my humble opinion. It's next to me on the stove all the time. And what's really cool about it is that it's actually made from a dried up Jurassic era seabed here in the United States in Utah. And they basically mine it like just raw how it is. It is packed with over 65 trace minerals and electrolytes. So for those of us on a keto diet or otherwise, the extra trace minerals are so valuable for our health and wellness and is so much more than just sodium. So definitely check that out. You can go to redmond.life, which is again, redmond.life, not .com, and you can place an order for their salt. They also have tons of other really cool products like toothpaste and face masks and all this kind of cool stuff. So they're really just an awesome company, but you can also find at almost any grocery store, their salt is in the spice aisle. So if you don't want to shop online, next time you're grocery shopping, check it out, go down that spice aisle, and I bet you'll be surprised to find it. So that's redmond.life. Discount code Chef Michael for 15% off. Thank you, Redmond. Now let's dive in. We have a very special guest, as I already told you. She is a MasterChef winner. She's now a celebrity chef. She's the host of MasterChef Latino in Central and in Central America and Mexico. She's also been on several Food Network shows. She's a published author and just an amazing human being. Welcome, Claudia Sandoval. It's like not great. It seems like maybe half as distant, but I'm glad you can laugh about this because I'm glad you could laugh about this and that like you're used to like.
What are we gonna do? Fucking cry? Like no.
Right. So that's why since you're working well, I don't think it's the software. I think it's just me. Okay. I think my Wi-Fi is just like shitting out. So let's just roll with it. We don't have a choice. Okay. You're used to like rolling with the punches, right?
Of course.
Yeah. Hi, Claudia, and welcome. Gosh, you make me smile. I'm so happy to have you here. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. I'm good. You know. other than the fact that I'm like dealing with a broken toe and some like COVID vaccine side effects, we are peachy king.
Well, look, I mean, you got to roll with the punches, right? As we've learned today, yeah. You got to roll with the punches. So yeah. I appreciate your positivity. Before we kind of dive in, and I'll tell you like generally with this podcast, our listeners already know this, but I don't ever come into this with like an agenda or a plan, but I have tons of questions for you just because like, man, like there's some cool stuff you're really doing. So I want to give you a chance to tell everybody maybe a brief little, you know, who the hell is Claudia? You know?
I don't know. Just kidding. No, I'm joking, obviously. It's like, hi, I'm Claudia Sandoval. I am the season 6 winner of MasterChef season 6. I already said that. The season 6 winner of MasterChef. I was a judge on MasterChef Latino. I'm now a judge on Food Network for a number of different shows. But my current one that actually premieres tonight March 1st, when we're recording this, is Easter Basket Challenge. So, and, you know, cookbook author, my cookbook's right there behind me.
You mean this?
Yes,
it's been, it's, to be honest, it's been on my shelf since before I even got the pleasure of meeting you. I have been a fan. Aww. So I fangirl a little bit when I got to meet you, and was so lucky that we kind of got like to be friends out of it a little bit, and just clicked on set. Yes. Back in LA, which is great, because well, that's a whole other topic, but I did not click with that many people on set, shall we say.
Oh, so, very interesting.
I really enjoyed getting to hang out with you for a few days at the set of MasterChef. Yeah, Claudia, you do some awesome stuff, and I really look up to what you're doing. You're one of the hardest people I know. You're also an entrepreneur.
I'm the hardest people you know.
Is that what I said? You're the hardest person I know.
I'm like hardest, huh?
Hardest working person. Let's add an extra word in there. I watch what you do on social media. You are on your feet all day, running your pop-up bakery, running around a TV set, you know, managing everything. I don't know how you do it. And a single mom, right?
Yep. Yep, yep, yep.
How do
you're already engaged. What am I going to do?
I know. But how do you keep up with this? I mean, really, how do you keep up with this? It's crazy.
You know, I don't know. I think, you know, I have a little ADD. I love to multitask. So, you know, sometimes I'll just kind of be catching up on, you know, my favorite series on TV, and I'll be updating social media or setting up my social media plan for the week so that things post, you know. I've been really lucky, honestly. I used to work in an advertising agency before this, and I had a lot of experience with, social media, not just the social media, like, posting, but strategy and like how to post what, and you know, looking at engagement, what day, what times, you know, things are creating more traction, and you know, and all of that, and just using those insights in order to create strategy. And you know, it's always interesting to me too, because you know, I want to post more food, but for some reason my selfies are the ones that get the most traction. So I'm like, I don't
always.
You know, so I just
It's always that way. It's like we just want to share our food, but that's not what Instagram wants us to share, I think.
No, exactly.
So you know what? That makes me think about something. So let's talk about this for a second. So did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Your video cut out.
Weird.
Okay, that's okay. Perfect. Well, it should still be recording fine, so we'll just kind of edit this in. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second, because you're making me think about an important topic, which is sort of the visual aspects of television and the entertainment business around food. And right. It's a very, I'm curious for you if it's as touchy of a subject for you as it is for me, because I never got into any of this. Wanting sort of the attention and like being on camera has never exactly been my thing. I say that as I'm on camera right now. but it's never really been my thing. It brings out a lot of insecurities in me. And so how has your journey been in kind of dealing with that? Is it hard for you still? Do you get insecure? Does it make you think about your looks, your body? Like, how is that for you?
Yeah. You know, I think like in general, and I don't mean this like in a cocky way, but like, I don't think that I've ever been like a very insecure person, like in terms of like being in public. I think I was like a natural born, like public speaker, you know, captain of like the speech and debate team in school. So like, it was something that public speaking was always something that I really liked and enjoyed. So I don't think that's a thing for me. I think there's two, you know, I think what your question kind of entails is really two-sided, right? I think it's the image and then it's the actual act, right? I think it is definitely very difficult to watch yourself back sometimes. And you're like, why do I, like one of the things I notice, right? Why do I tilt my head like this so much, you know? But it's something that I've caught myself doing naturally. Yeah, I do it, you know, I kind of do this all the time, or like I'll be looking at something and like confused. I do like the pug tilt, I call it, you know. I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard to hear yourself. I think it's hard to look back at yourself and because, you know, we're our own worst critics. We sit there and criticize like, oh gosh, look at how my arm looks there. Or, oh, look at all those rolls, you know, especially as a plus size woman, you know, I know that there are people out there who, you know, just are fat shaming, you know, and so I get it, you know, and so, but on the flip side of that, I also see that I have this incredible platform to be able to really change the perspective for little girls and little boys out there that feel the way that I do, and to show them that, like, you can be any size, you can be, you know, you can look whichever way, you know, you can have red, blue, green hair, whatever you choose. And so long as you go out there and do your best and, put your best foot forward, then really, like, people will love you. You know, the people that are going to be your people are going to love you, are going to find you, and are going to support you. And, you know, I always tell everybody, you know, there is no competition. There's enough out there for all of us. And the people that aren't going to like me is fine. But I just, you know, I've also come to accept that, but I've also never been like a very, like, you know, envious person or anything like that. So I don't see myself and then compare myself to like another chef and think, oh God, I wish I was as skinny as her, you know, or, oh right. God, I wish I, you know, I had her complexion. Like, no, I'm Claudia Sandoval, and I'm special, fabulous, and wonderful just because of who I am, you know, and I bring something to the table that nobody else does. And that's what's amazing. You know, nobody out there is the same as you. So shine, baby, shine.
I love it. I'm so glad you're saying that, because I very much see you as like, well, first of all, you're absolutely gorgeous, but I just thank see you as being so unapologetically you, and who you are. Your personality on and off camera is identical. I think a lot of people, you know, assume that when we go on these TV shows or whatever, we like put on these characters, or production forces us into characters. And I don't really see that from you. I think you really do just kind of shine as who you are. And that being said, I think, you know, when I watch you on social media, you're very clear about your politics, your beliefs, your ethos, like who you stand for, what you stand for. And I love it. You know, I think I see you as kind of being a leader to women, to being a leader to your daughter and other girls who may be watching right now. And I think that's really cool that you're really kind of saying whatever the hell it is that you believe, because you think it's important. And we, you know, I love that about you. Does it ever make you wonder, do you ever think like, oh man, like what, you know, is Food Network going to want this? Or do you get in your head about that stuff?
Absolutely. Are you kidding? I mean, these are the people that are going to pay my bills, right? I mean, I've had, you know, I consider myself a moderate, but I have like staunch Republicans who, you know, are opposed to me, you know, posting things about not wanting kids to be in cages, you know, and saying, you know, you just lost another customer because you can't keep politics out of your, you know, out of your business. And it's like, I'm sorry, like you can't pretend to want to support a Mexican business and then want to lock up our kids in cages. Like, you know, to me, those things are, you know, they're counterintuitive. And so, I understand it. And yes, I mean, I think it would be silly for me to say it doesn't cross your mind. But I think for me, you know, at the end of the day, the person that has to live with Claudia Sandoval is Claudia Sandoval. You know, I have to be able to go to sleep at night and, live with my conscience. And I've always, a lot of people don't know this, but I'm a philosophy major. I have a degree in philosophy. And so one of the things that I will never forget, you know, just really obviously in terms of ethics and all of that, right? I remember reading a quote, something along the lines of like, you know, if you stand for nothing, like, you know, what happens if you stand for nothing, right? If you don't stand up for something, then what do you even, you know, what are you standing on? And that's so true. And you know, if people don't know what I stand for, then I stand for nothing. And that's definitely not who I am as a person. You know, I am, you know, I'm through and through Latina, all the way to like, being like the gripey mom who's gonna like tell you how it is, you know, whether you like it or not. I'm that way to my friends. I'm that way to my significant others when I have those. You know, that's just, it's like, in Spanish, we say que no tienes pelos en la lengua, which means you don't have hairs on your tongue. You like, don't hold back, you know, like I am like as blunt as it goes. Both, you know, like you said, in front of the, you know, cameras or behind the cameras, it's just who I am. And I don't think that I should apologize for being a strong Latina. I don't think that I should apologize for having a voice. And I don't think that I should, you know, stop that. Even if, you know, these networks decide that they don't want to work with me because I stand for something, I rather stand for something than stand for nothing. And, you know, have, feel as though I'm letting myself down or letting, you know, my ethics or what I stand for down.
Yeah. You're preaching my language. It's hard. You know, it's hard when we're in a position where our livelihood is at stake. It's very tricky because, you know, we want to succeed and provide for our families. Like there's nobody writing you or I like a paycheck every 2 weeks, right? Like it's a very tricky thing to be so independent and so entrepreneurial. And it feels like everything's always kind of on the edge of collapse. And I mean, at least for me, I don't know if you ever feel that way in this entertainment business. Like you probably don't always know when your next big gig is going to be, I would guess, right? So I understand, but I also respect your ability to say, fuck it. <You know? laughs> I love that.
I mean, listen, there have definitely been times where I have even had conversations with my management and said, I don't know if I want to work with X network because they're doing this in their politics, you know, and diversity is a really big, important one for me. And if a network isn't, you know, being inclusive enough, like, it's like, well, why do I have to fight for my seat at the table? But I think that that's also a super important thing to talk about, right? If you don't have a seat at the table, can you ever change anything? So I think that there is definitely like a give and take there. I think where we definitely have to be unapologetic is when things are really just, you know, a hard stop. They, you know, if we come to an impasse on something that's just super important, I think that that's really, you know, more and more, I think we're seeing it. And with this whole, everybody's talking about cancel culture, right? But I think, you know, now more than ever, we are seeing that it is important to stand for something. And people want to know when you go, I've seen multiple people being attacked because they're not making a decision or they're not making a statement as to where they stand on a certain subject. And people have, you know, that's also now being seen as negative, you know, that's negatively impacting businesses because the silence also speaks volumes. So I think that, you know, it's sometimes it is a stuck between a rock and a hard place, but I think all we can do is try to navigate it with as much honesty and integrity as we can. And so long as we stick to our ethos and to what we really truly believe, you know, it is what it is, right? We're not all going to agree. I just hope that people remember at the end of the day that it's something that I hold near and dear to my heart. And, you know, again, whoever's going to want to be on Team Claudia is going to be Team Claudia forever, you know?
I'm Team Claudia. so I don't know. Okay, I'm going to pivot a little bit because you said tonight. Now, by the time this airs, it'll probably be like have been out for a while. But tonight you have the first episode of the Food Network show that you filmed. And you, if I'm not mistaken, the two co-hosts with you, one was a Black woman and a Filipino male. Is that correct?
That so is
we're talking
correct.
Diversity. That is pretty freaking cool. Very exciting to see a female and minority dominated panel on a Food Network show. Because frankly, a lot of Food Network stars have been white. Let's be very honest. And so I'm really happy to see this. Now, I don't know because we didn't pre-discuss this. I know with MasterChef, you know, obviously we signed some, you know, non-disclosures on certain things, but what was your experience like? You can share as much or as little detail as you want, but both for me and for anybody listening, what's a little behind the scenes here? What's it like filming an episode? How long does it take? You know, give us some scoop about what it feels like to film a Food Network show.
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, most stuff for Food Network is filmed in New York. So right. A lot of people think anything filmed is Hollywood, 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 LA. That's not true. So you have to fly to New York. We filmed this, I want to say it was like back in November of last year. So we filmed it in November. So yes, it's all pre-recorded. We all know who's winning, right? Much like most of the shows that you watch on television, it always cracks me up when people are like, well, how do you know if you haven't filmed it yet? I'm like, come on, guys. How do you ask me weeks for the next week if we haven't recorded it yet? So it's really funny. But yeah, we filmed it last November. And obviously things were, you know, things were crazy with COVID. And so that was a little difficult. But the cool thing about it was that we got tested every other day. Everybody on set was on quarantine. We were, you know, I wasn't allowed to visit any of my New York friends. So it was all very, very different. I mean, I had to put on a mask as soon as I walked out of my green room, you know, onto set. And then it wasn't until like right when they called, you know, kind of action, if you will.
Right.
That we were able to take off our masks. So, you know, our makeup artists were definitely having a really hard time with like trying to keep the lipstick on and stuff. But on the flip side, I mean, in terms of what I can tell you about the show, it's long. It's a long, long day. I want to say that our first day we filmed, or we were on set, or I was awake for like 22 hours. So it takes a lot longer than people think. You know, you have to add in breaks, you have to add in lunches. And a lot of these, especially, you know, if you're familiar with like these kind of what we call show pieces, right? Easter Basket Challenge is going to feature a smaller item, smaller challenge, plus a large show piece every single episode. And so these show pieces require about a 4 to 5 hour build. So when you're thinking about 4 to 5 hours, and then you build that into all of the other things that have to happen, including, you know, hair and makeup, including lunches, including breakfast, including, you know, all of that, you're talking about at least a 12-hour day. And so it's a lot that then it gets condensed into 1 hour. And so you lose a lot. I honestly haven't seen any of the cuts, but I hope that they're able to capture some of the good and the bad, because there was a lot of both. We had a lot of tears. We had a lot of pieces fall apart.
I mean, that sounds like Food Network gold, tears and things falling apart. That's, I don't think they skipped out on those items in the edit.
Yeah. It's going to be such a fun show, but on top of that, I think, it'll really inspire a lot of creativity. There's some really impressive work that goes on with different mediums. And I think that it'll give a lot of people some really exciting ideas for things that they can create at home, or the ways that they can decorate for their Easter treats.
Yeah. I mean, how different is the experience? I mean, obviously two very different shows in structure, two different networks, but how different is it being a judge on MasterChef Latino? And where do you film that versus Food Network, since you mentioned New York?
Yeah, MasterChef Latino is a Telemundo show, and Telemundo films out of Doral in Florida, which is a couple miles inland from Miami. So, it's a city called Doral, and they have like this huge, huge studio with multiple studios within it, it's a lot different, but it's also a lot of sort of the same, right? I think the biggest difference is, you know, MasterChef, in general, as a staple, right, is mostly like that kind of, you know, it's pretty similar in style, in that it has like 1 hour at most, 90 minutes, for a challenge. And so, generally right. You're able to condense that a lot more. The thing though, of course, with MasterChef, as you know, a lot of, you know, is you have kind of those like, the reaction, you know, like the in studio, like, you know, Becky's a bitch or whatever.
The diary cam.
Debriefing, you know?
Yeah, I call it the diary cam.
What's that?
I call it the diary cam.
Yeah.
Sort exactly. of the verbal diary. Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that, you know, I think that definitely adds a lot more time to filming, instead of just being able to get over, you know, get in and out because you've done the challenges. You still have to film that. There's still a lot of practice that is involved with MasterChef, and a lot of that isn't necessarily true for the baking shows. The baking shows are a lot different in that sense because they already kind of come with an idea of like what's required of them. And so, you know, there has to be some sort of pre-planning. And MasterChef, as you know, we don't get that pre-planning. It's right. Like, and this is your challenge and go, you know? Right. So there's definitely some very big differences there. But I would say that the baking part is a lot more difficult because you're dealing with a long period of time with no commercial refrigeration, you know, or glass right. chillers or things like that, that can hold, you know, huge pieces or show pieces. So, you know, after 5 hours, any Rice Krispies treats is going to fall apart, right? Because it's butter and it's sugar.
Yeah, but shouldn't they know that? Yeah. I mean, you'd think somebody would show up kind of planning their menu around those parameters, or they're just people who just don't think about it. You know?
I'm going to let you watch them for that one.
Got it. Okay, cool. Yeah, time. Interesting.
Like, you know, at this point, you know, let's be honest, right? The majority of shows are kind of variations of other shows, right? I mean, yes, they are ingenious and you know, the challenges and the different, you know, there are definitely different things, but it's like, guys, like we've seen showpieces being made since the 80s, you know? We know how long it takes sugar work to start to fall apart in humidity, right. You know? So it's always very funny to me that people don't think I'm in a studio. There are going to be lights. It will be hot. Like I'm going to be sweating. I'm going to be breathing on this thing. You know, it's always been very fascinating to me that people don't take that into consideration more because yeah. that would be the first thing I would be thinking about. How can I create Same. Something that I can like screw together and keep in small, right. you know, in small sizes that I can keep in the fridge while I'm working right. on the rest of it.
That's yeah, what I'm thinking too. Like even as you were talking, I was like, well, then you start there as your first kind of point of business is like, I have to make sure that this is going to actually hold up for hours and hours. But yeah, I guess people think their own ways, but that's also why you've won a competition show. Cause you have a brain.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of that is strategy. I always yeah, say, everybody yeah. always says like, why do you think you won? And I'm like, one, I was there to win. I wasn't there to make friends. And two, I built a strategy. There was a very clear strategy on how to win. And that really involves being smart about what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, like literally walked into my next question. Cause you know, I think that, we see this a lot in cooking competition shows and stuff where people are so focused on kind of like, I think what I would call ego-driven decision-making, like trying to make the fanciest food and this and that possible. In my observation, that's not always the best approach, you know, both in observing other people, but also within myself. You know, I'm curious your thoughts on that, because I think that there's a lot of the mainstream kind of reward system around chefs and chef culture is around like Michelin star. And yeah. this and that. And it's like, sometimes I feel like it's a little frustrating because there's a very specific kind of Eurocentric view on what good food is in the culinary world. And for a long time, it's starting to shift a little bit at a time. Yeah. But for a long time, ethnic food, global foods, anything that really wasn't like white French cuisine was not looked at, wasn't even available to be on a Michelin star. Now we've added certain countries in Asia, but it's still very slow. I think that there's been a lot of conversation around specifically Latin and Mexican food. There's a lot of conversation around other forms, like Filipino food is finally having like a little bit of a moment where it's being taken seriously. African food is finally, you know, Ghanaian food and Nigerian food is finally being taken seriously. It's still not seen the way that like French food is seen, both on TV and in the culinary world. So talk to me a little bit about your thoughts around this and why. I mean, is it just racism? Like, what's the issue? Why has it taken so long for people to take Mexican food seriously? Because I personally think it's if not one of, it is the best cuisine in the world. Aww. Just curious your thoughts on that.
That's a big question. You know, and I'm just going to kind of gloss over it, and I'm not trying to, you know, literally do that. But I think that one of the things that's really important to remember is that, you know, we are a world that has really been colonized a lot. In fact, by many of those countries, whether it's France, whether it's Spain, I mean, just last night I was at dinner and my waiter was Spanish from Spain, from Madrid. And we were just having this conversation. And I said, why is it that you guys see Mexicans as like inferior to you? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, but that's literally why I left Spain. That type of like racism, classism is just not okay. And it's really heartbreaking because I had just gone to Spain just before COVID hit in February of 2020. And, you know, and it's heartbreaking, I think, because like you said, there really is some incredible flavors. I mean, I think, you know, Mexican food and Indian food for me are like just right there, you know, some of our spice blends in order to create some of these really complex sauces include more than 15 to 20 ingredients. And I mean, you have nobody in the world doing things like that. You know, just in terms of complexity of building flavor and building, you know, what that cultural cuisine is like, I think just really highlights how much more complex and how much more thought out that flavor building is. And yet it's seen as, you know, just tacos, burritos and enchiladas and butter chicken, you know. And I think that that's incredibly frustrating. But a lot of that, I think, just has to do with the fact that these, you know, these cultures have felt superior because they have been superior in history. You know, at the end of the day, you know, France was, you know, the ultimate culinary power because they created the brigade system. They were the ones to first create Escoffier schools, right? And so when you talk about just in terms of the creation of what is now considered the standard for restaurants and chefs and that whole thing, I mean, even the word chef, right? So it's very interesting that, you know, yes, that happens. Will it change? I don't know. I mean, I think it would have to really take a lot of education. We as cultural people have to, you know, take it upon ourselves to really educate people on the complexities of what we're making. You know, one of the things that always cracks me up too, though, is the other side of that. And this is kind of why I wanted to say, why I said I want to kind of gloss over it, because, you know, a lot of people now say like, well, that's not authentically Mexican. And I'm like, well, what is authentically Mexican? Because, for example, I own a Mexican panaderia, right? A Mexican panaderia is a Mexican bakery. But we didn't even have flour in Mexico until the Spanish came in the 1500s to Mexico. Right. So when you think about, you know, a birote is just essentially a baguette. And when you think about, you know, a concha, it really is. It is very much like a brioche. And so, you know, I hate it because it is what it is. But the fact of the matter is that we have to understand that a lot of our food was based on, you know, on the roots of those ingredients that were brought to the Americas from these other countries. So, you know, a lot of these foods across the world, including Filipino food, has a lot of Spanish influence because they were, you know, colonized by the Spanish. And so I think that colonization is a really big part of that conversation. I think that, you know, as people become a little bit more globalized and really take the initiative to really learn and to do their research about these different cultures and try to learn a little bit about their food, they'll be really, really, really surprised by what they'll find, you know, because Cinco de Mayo isn't about Mexican independence, right? It's about the Battle of Puebla, and Puebla has one of the best moles, you know, and mole poblano is a 47 ingredient kind of mole. So all of those things, you know, and so I would love for people to really do their research and start to change the perspective and not just to continue to, you know, propagate all of these stereotypes of what they think our food is.
Right. Well, and it's very, first of all, it's really true. I think the way that history has connected food, because food is kind of the great unifier, and you could see the influence of foods kind of like touching each other from various cultures and neighbors. But, you know, in today's culture, okay, there's not, it's not super, well, especially during COVID, but in general, it's not super accessible for most people to have access to good cuisine, depending on where you live, your financial situation, all these other factors. There's not really food equity around getting knowledgeable about food. It's amazing how many Americans, their only reference for like what is Chinese food is, you know, General Tso's. And the only reference for Mexican food is burritos and enchiladas, which, as we know, is a very different discussion. Right. Or Taco Bell. Exactly. Which is as American as McDonald's, in my opinion. And so there's a big equity issue around access to food in this country. And one of the only ways today that people are getting close to accessing food is through social media and television, right? Food television is a big source of information. But when I look at Food Network, I don't see that many shows talking about Mexican food. There have been some Mexican food stars on the Food Network, but not prolific stars. And so I guess my question is, obviously, we both, you and me, would love to see you continue to share your food on a larger stage. Do you feel some responsibility? Do you feel like some weight that, like, if you can share this, you can maybe help people see what Mexican food really is and how it connects to New Age culture, to American culture as well? Do you feel kind of like a pressure when you're on that, you know, on that set that you have to represent this whole thing? I mean, it just, it feels like such an important topic and you're kind of thrown into the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I consider it pressure. I think I consider it a responsibility, you know? I think that it's not so much like I feel pressured, like, oh gosh, this is something that, you know, but I definitely think that I...
History is on your shoulders.
Yeah. The weight of the Mexican culture is
food. the whole country and history.
Definitely not what that's like. But, you know, I think it is super important for, you know, as somebody that's given a platform to then share things that, you know, for example, I mean, in the finale of MasterChef, I served Gordon Ramsay a huitlacoche tamale with, you know, which is with it, like, I guarantee you that like 95% of the people who watched MasterChef had never heard of huitlacoche. And huitlacoche is like, is essentially a corn that has had a fungus grow on it that causes it to kind of change and into like a mushroom. And it's delicious. And it's like,
I was going to say, by the way, it's so delicious.
Yeah. Super good. And you know, but a lot of people didn't know about it. And it's, you know, it's hailed as, quote, the Mexican truffle. But here is that, again, that differentiation to something European, right? So, you know, it doesn't have to be a truffle. It's just amazing on its own because it really isn't like a truffle. It doesn't taste like a truffle. It doesn't smell like a truffle. It's nothing like a truffle, right? I think that they're just trying to add value to it. But, you know, I think that using things like that and really, again, I think so much of what I have to do and the responsibility that I have and that everybody I think that is, you know, given a platform or that uses their platform, has that responsibility to do their research and to really share that research. You know, if, you know, Michael, for example, the other day I saw you making carnitas, you know, I think it's important to talk about carnitas, you know, is like the other day I went to a restaurant and they called carnitas confit pork. And it's like, no, it's carnitas. Do you get what I'm saying? So
I had to take a moment of silence.
Like, let me just blink it away. Yeah, trust me, I feel the same way. So my point to you is, I think, you know, even sharing some of that, even sharing like a tidbit of knowledge, even if it's like a, did you know, like a one, did you know, like, did you know that huitlacoche wasn't even eaten until whatever, you get my point. So I think, you know, so much of what we do and what our responsibility as chefs is to really do our research, one, because I don't know everything about Mexican food, I guarantee you. So it's important to do our research, one. Two, I think it's incredibly important to share that research, because the only way that we're all going to become more educated and understand so much more about culture so that we're not continuing to propagate all of those stereotypes is by sharing that knowledge, right? Is by sharing like, hey, did you guys know that in Mexico we have a saffron little ball, but it's not the threads, but it does the same thing as a saffron and it has the same properties, but it's a ball and it comes from a tree. So like even those types of things, you know, that, that people would have never guessed and would have never known. Just sharing, I think, those little tidbits of knowledge is so important.
Interesting. So yeah. So you brought up me making carnitas. So let's get real. How do you feel about that, right? Like, what's the line between appreciation and appropriation?
I think the line I literally just wrote an article for a magazine today about Cinco de Mayo and about cultural appropriation. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing for, I'm going to speak for myself. I'm not going to speak for my whole culture because I don't think that I have that right.
Again, the whole country of Mexico is on your shoulders.
It's on my shoulders. You know, I think like one of the super important things to remember is at some level, we are all taking an appropriation of another culture. That is one big thing, right? But I think that too, the most important thing is to educate yourself. You know, like I said, you know, do your research. What is the history of carnitas? If you're going to make a dish, don't just take it as like, oh, I'm just going to go pull some, you know, recipe off the internet and make it. No. Where were carnitas made? Do you know? Where were carnitas developed?
I don't know. I was actually, the only reason that I would ever, I don't know. But I was taught to make carnitas from a Mexican chef, a female chef who worked in a food truck. She brought me into her food truck and I spent 2 hours with her watching her boil the pork down. Like I watched the whole process. I did, you know, no, I don't know the history. Call me out. However, no, I didn't just like find some recipe for, you know.
You're going to make carnitas on your Instagram, right? You're going to show people how to make carnitas. Then share that. Share the fact that your friend, I don't know what her name was, your friend took you in and showed you how to make carnitas and that this is the way her family makes it.
Right.
And then just, it's as simple as a Google search, right?
Right.
Where were carnitas it's made, true. Right? Michoacán is the state that carnitas came from.
Right.
So, you know, and just providing, again, those like little tidbits of information, showing that you've done your research, that you, in other words, that you have done the job of making sure that what you're doing is correct.
Because it's like a little bit of respect. It's like showing one second of like respect that I'm here to learn as well.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, it's like, yes, you're going to make the carnitas, but I'm sure that they're not going to come out as good as your friends, right?
With all of course, never, never, they never will be. Nor would I claim them to be. but a lot of white people have said it's the best carnitas ever, you know? it's nowhere near, and I would never claim it to be. It could never be. There's, you know, but.
Well, and they call it sazón mexicano, right? Sazón is like your seasoning. Like
the
your
seasoning. Mm-hmm.
It's your touch on a recipe, right? And so I think like, you know, and I wasn't trying to diss you. It wasn't a diss.
No, I know.
Like you know what I mean. Like, it's like when I try to make my friend's recipe, it never comes out the same, you know? Because it's that person, and that person knows what it's supposed to look like and what it's supposed to smell like, and you know the exact point at which the onions caramelize, because if they caramelize too much, then it turns sweet and it doesn't have any of the bitterness, and like all of those like little nuances that, you know, come with knowing exactly when something's supposed to be done in a recipe, that really are variables that change because of temperature, because of the wind, because of the this, because of the that. You know, all of those things are variables that only the chef that has truly made that before understands. And so I think to go back to your question between appropriation and what isn't, I think at the end of the day, if you do your research and you are not continuing to propagate stereotypes, is, you know, if you're making carnitas wearing a fucking sombrero and being like, ah, that's not okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's not okay. Yeah. But if you are sitting there making carnitas and you're just like, this is the way my friend taught me, you know, I would be interested to hear like, how does your family make them? Or, you know, what kind of recipe ideas do you guys have? And really continuing to share that conversation of like, I know that they originated in Michoacán, but I've heard that now there's, you know, from the coast, like for where my family's from, we make a swordfish carnitas. So like a fish carnitas that are like, you know, kind of done the same. Exactly.
Fascinating.
But, yeah. So things like that, and just really learning and continuing that learning process, because I think, again, food is so complex by region. The same way that you think about Italian food being regional, right? Sicilians are not the same as the Milanese, right? And so when you start to think about food as regional, you stop thinking of it as just Mexican, right? Mexicans from Veracruz cook very different as Mexicans from Sonora, as different as they cook from Chihuahua. Mm-hmm. Everybody cooks differently. And so, you know, I think that that's super important to know. And even within Mexicans, there's disagreement about like whether things are quote traditional or not.
Right.
And that's always fascinating too, because when you talk to Italianos, they say the same thing. They're like, well, that's not even how pasta is made. Pasta is made with just yolks. Oh no. Well, I use the whole egg. Oh, well, I use no egg, you know? So it's fascinating how cultures are that way. But I think in terms of appropriation, do your research. Spend the time. We're so lucky now to have Google and to be able to use all of these different search engines in order to be able to have that information on the tip of our hands. And by the way, look it up in that language. I know that seems like a super weird thing to say, but we have Google Translate now, guys. Like, you can literally drop a whole paragraph into Google Translate and translate it from Spanish to English and be like, yeah. Oh, wow. Because a lot of the times the information that's provided in the United States is already kind of like that more glossed over recipe, right? Or that more glossed over, you know, that more glossed over kind of piece of history. And when you go onto the bigger websites with the right language, you'll see a lot more.
Right. I totally agree. Obviously, I agree. But I think that's also important, like for food bloggers or people who are kind of using food in the entertainment space, I think it's all like language really matters. Understanding the proper names of the ingredients and when to use them, but even like vernacular around this dish is not authentic carnitas. It's inspired by the carnitas that this woman made me, right? Like there's language that you can use. And we see this on the web all the time. People saying like, oh, authentic this and that. And it's like, no, like that's inspired by something you had in China or whatever. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, exactly.
I think being honest and being kind of truthful about where food is coming from, using the right language is another right way. Like just me as a blogger now, I don't do as much with TV anymore, but as a blogger, I try to be really conscious of that. Like I am very inspired by food from all over the world. I really am, not only from my travels and my experiences, but like, even sort of like local traveling, you know, like you go to LA or you go to Chinatown in New York. Like I get really inspired by that stuff. And I want to be able to cook that. I want to be able to make my food inspired and interesting and take some of these cues from other cultures. I did a private dinner where I did a hoisin mole, where I introduced some hoisin sauce into a mole. And it was kind of this like Mexican fusion dinner that I did for Mario Lopez. And it was like super kind of out there. And we use huitlacoche and, you know, use like various inspired ingredients, but I never called it Mexican food. I think that was something that I was very careful not to do.
Right.
And very intentional about that. And so I think having intentionality and being sort of transparent, you know, not calling something it's not is important. I agree. So kind of here's the other end of the coin. So I'll kind of twist it back on you a little bit. And by the way, do not apologize for calling me out ever, both on this podcast and anywhere else. I'm always here to learn. I am not above it. And I'd rather you call me out than not. And so I can learn too. But here's kind of the other side of this, which is as a Latina in the entertainment industry, do you ever feel like you get boxed in?
Yeah, 100%. Like it's, 100%. I mean, I felt that way when I was on MasterChef, you know, like I felt like whenever it wasn't a dish that was traditionally Mexican, I felt like I never was noticed. You know, if I made a seafood pasta, like, you know, with clams and chorizo and all of these Mexican flavors, it wasn't highlighted because it wasn't Mexican, you know, even though I was using Mexican ingredients and it was more of a fusion, it still didn't matter, you know? And so You know, when I made chicken and waffles, you know, they were expecting me to make, you know, a Mexican kind of chicken. They asked me why I didn't make a cilantro lime chicken. And I'm like, cilantro lime chicken with waffles? Like, in my head was like, what are you talking about? We would never do that, you know? But listen, you know, I think that that is also a catch 22, right? Just because I'm a Latina chef doesn't mean that that's all I can do. Right. And so I think that that's honestly one of the reasons why I went in the bread direction too, was because I wanted to also change that conception. People always be like, oh, so what kind of chef are you? Are you a pastry chef or are you a savory chef? And even going back to your conversation earlier, well, that's a misconception too, because in my culture, there is no differentiation. In Mexico, there is no differentiation from a savory chef and a person that makes bread at home. Everybody makes their own bread. They make their own tortillas. They make their own bread. They make their own food. They make all of it. In Arabic cultures, they make their own flatbreads. You know, in Indian food, they make, you know, their own, what is it called?
Like paratha or naan, your paratha, or all of it.
Exactly,
yeah.
Your naan. They make all of that stuff. So it's really fascinating that everybody tries to really kind of pigeonhole all of our foods into those two different categories. And so when, you know, when everybody kept being like, oh, well, she's the Latina chef. She only cooks, you know, and then they pigeonholed me even further. She only makes coastal seafood. And it's like, well, I don't just make seafood. You know, I also make moles, which are mostly known in Oaxaca and Puebla. But I make moles and I make this and I make that and I make these other things. So which belong to, yes, other regions, but don't just pigeonhole me to like a little region and say like, that's all I can cook.
Well, it frustrates me though, because sometimes I feel like on TV or in restaurants, even like white male chefs seem to be able to get away with a lot. Like it's
100%.
It's no big deal. Like you could have a Michelin star sushi restaurant with a white man in it, but like dare a Japanese woman open an Italian restaurant and be taken seriously, or you know what I mean? It's like
100%.
It's frustrating.
In San Diego, the only taqueria that has Michelin recognition in San Diego is headed by a white man.
Yeah.
In San Diego, in Southern California,
an hour from the border,
Mexicanos everywhere.
Right.
An American man making tacos is the one that, you know, and so and by the way, he's a great friend and I love him and I respect him and he's done his research and I know, but also it's not his fault.
Yeah.
It's not his fault. It's just what society has allowed to happen. To your point, Americans can, you know, or not Americans, but you know, generally white chefs can get away with cooking all kinds of food. They can be making everything from dumplings to, you know, to tacos.
In one restaurant, they can do that and get away with it.
100%. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do the same. So it's very frustrating. But again, you know, it's like, I think as a minority, having lived in this country for my whole life, you start to realize that like, you're going to, as terrible as this is going to sound, like you're going to take what you can get and push the envelope only as far as you can. And then the generation behind you is going to have to push further. You know, that's just the name of the game when you're a minority.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, little decisions. If a few people listen to this, you know, maybe they'll think about it too, because it's definitely something that we in the industry think a lot about, I think, when we're in it. I think it's really tricky when in the entertainment space specifically, this is not something that I think the average consumer notices on television, but we who've been kind of behind the curtain see this a lot, where everybody is put in a box and are really forced to stay in that box. Often, I think that it's a tricky subject for me and I get frustrated because like my personal experience on television, one thing, my food message, and though it wasn't a cultural message, my food message around eating healthy and eating keto was completely washed out. It was not allowed, to be honest. I was literally told that I cannot use a series of words on television, basically, including like healthy, nutritious, keto. And it hurts me a lot because it's something that I'm really passionate about. And so I think when we're put in these sort of culinary boxes in the entertainment space, it can be really damaging. Some of these boxes like close us in. Some of them also like box out other things. Like you said, like you weren't able to flex, you know, a chicken and waffles or a seafood pasta. Even though I'm sure it was delicious, it wasn't taken seriously. And I think it's a problem. I really do, because I think the culinary world deserves a little bit better than that. But somehow when you like step out of TV, you know, some white guy covered in tattoos can like make dumplings and tacos and a Peking duck in the same restaurant and get away with it. But I think for a lot of us who've been on TV, it feels like we're supposed to be this one thing and one thing only. And I think it's just an important topic to discuss. It's something that I have found frustration in a little bit. I see it a lot, even like through the press tour with my book. I've seen it on TV. You know, I think there's a lot of networks. Like we were in discussions with Today Show, and Today Show's like, yeah, keto's just like, it's too controversial, you know? And then a few weeks later, I saw this like couple on the Today Show talking about their weight loss journey, but like they never explained the diet or something. It was weird. And then like you look it up and they did lose their weight through keto, but like Today Show didn't want them ever using that word. It felt like to me, like I could kind of see through it. And I know I'm making this about keto. We were on a cultural discussion, but I think it's a larger issue around food on television that like it's easier for the bigger populations of Americans to kind of digest food in these very clear little columns, like Mexican food is this and Chinese food is this and Southern food is this. I've been in a lot of discussions with several members of like an online community that I'm a part of that are Black chefs. It's like a discussion where people can discuss this. And during Black History Month, there was basically a lot of discussion in this community around when we think of Black food in America, all we think of is Southern food. That's 100%. The box that food that is what we're told to associate with Black food is Southern food, when in fact that is a huge part of it, but there's also regional changes in that. And there's also African influences in that, kind of like how you were saying there's a history of it. Like when slaves were brought to the islands in the Caribbean, you have these like combinations of Caribbean food and African influences that have then come to America. Like it's like this whole mix mash, and African food is amazingly complex and very culinary, but it's not taken seriously. And it's like, there's not that much room for a sort of public view of that culinary, that cuisine. I think it's an important topic. And I see this in a lot of different cultures. I see it in Mexican food. I see it in Asian food, where it's like, you're supposed to stay in your little box, you know, to your point, the difference between regional Mexican cuisine is just as vast as the difference between like Southern cuisine and California cuisine, right? Like these are like two completely different foods, different ingredients, but somehow that's like normalized in America. But the idea that in Mexico there's different cuisines is somehow like very confusing to Americans. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know.
I agree with you completely, but to go further with that, I think that one of the big important parts of the conversation too is that the people that, when these networks are looking at the demographic of the people that are watching these shows, you are dealing with parts of the country that don't necessarily have, to your point, a lot of those ingredients, a lot of those cultures. A lot of the Midwest doesn't have a ton of Mexican people or Ethiopian people or Haitian people or, you know, Japanese people. And so what starts to happen is, you know, they as terrible as this is going to sound, I feel like many of these silos that are created to have kind of more digestible ways of approaching food, is to try to educate, but really it's a dumbing down, right? It's you're dumbing it down and thinking, oh, let's speak to them in layman's terms about food. And it's like, no, teach them about food. If you know, if especially people like Food Network and Discovery and, you know, what are the other ones? You know, even the larger networks like Fox and all of these, the Travel Channel, like all of these other channels that are doing food related shows, especially with the travel ones, where you're actually talking about food, like, let's go a little bit deeper than just, you know, let's glossing over and like, let's see the barbecue in Memphis, you know, things like that. I think that there's just a bigger conversation to have instead of just hitting the points that everybody already knows about. You know, it's like, that's a dumbing down of food culture. And that's,
it is.
And that's frustrating. And I say it as somebody who has literally been told, well, I don't think that that show would sit well with people because they've never heard of these things before. And I'm like, what? You know, so they're like, no, we want you to kind of make it more digestible, just kind of more top level. Just bring it in more top level. Don't go into the source of the ingredients. And it's like, why don't we want to teach people about the source of their ingredients? Like, I don't understand, you know? Hmm. So I think a lot of it is, to your point, is just trying to create more digestible bits of information, but that's also not true. A lot that people didn't love Anthony Bourdain because he was superficial, you know, they loved it because he would get there and have the really difficult conversations about like, why are you guys in peril right now? And why are you guys selling food on the street when there's like a war 3 miles away from you, you know? And so I think that a lot of that tells you so much about culture, you know, and having those really tough conversations. But if we keep trying to avoid conflict or trying to avoid difficult conversations or difficult subjects, you know, I've always wanted to do about a show about the border and foods at the border, you know, and how they're very similar on both sides. You know, you can have a hot chicken wings, you know, hot chicken and wings in Tijuana. And then you can have like chilaquiles in San Diego, and you know, these border towns are just like amazing, you know? And so I don't know. I think there's a lot to learn. And I think if these networks are really serious about bringing in diversity, then the conversation really needs to be about bringing in that diversity as a whole and not trying to dumb down culture in order for it to be a digestible thing for Americans to accept.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think we're getting closer. Yeah. I do think we're getting closer day by day, but it feels like a longer process than I think any of us would wish for.
I agree.
It's tricky.
It is.
It's really tricky. So let's pivot a little bit. This we'll kind of throw you for a little loop here. Correct me if I'm wrong. You have tried keto, have you not?
I have.
Now, be honest. Be honest. No, 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 no.
I don't
do
macros like you do and all that.
Well, I don't do macros either, but I know what you mean. But be honest. So, like, look, I've brought in some keto guests as well to the podcast, but I want to, like, hear from you, good and bad, the good, bad, and the ugly. What did you feel about it? I'm just curious your thoughts. Like, be honest. I want it all. You know, this isn't like a keto podcast.
Okay. The good was I felt really good. Carbs definitely bring down my energy level. They like just tank it. So I actually, believe it or not, kind of started doing keto when I was on MasterChef. I stopped eating carbs during lunch. I would just stick to like only veggies and only protein. Cheeses, things like that. Any starches I would just cut out because, when we would have lunch, we'd have like, you know, the continuation of the challenge after, and I would just feel like I was just so tired, you know, like I couldn't concentrate. So I started doing that. And then I obviously noticed it really seriously then. So, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm doing keto. At that point, like keto wasn't, I mean, it probably was around. I just didn't really know about it.
Right.
So then about maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I want to say, I got really serious about like losing some weight. I had hit like an all-time high. I think I hit like 350 pounds and I was like, I need to lose some weight. And I got on keto because one of my makeup artist had told me about how she had lost like 200 pounds on keto. And then she went vegan after that. And so she lost like another, you know, like whatever. It was like crazy. She's tiny now. And so I was like, wow, she got that thin. Like, I just want to lose like 100 pounds, you know? And so just. I started,
I know. I've been trying to get to 100 pounds for 3 years and I can't do it. So just.
So, you know, so yeah, so that was my goal. And I lost 50 pounds really quickly, which was wonderful. But what I started to feel, how can I say it? Like, I started to feel like I would go through like I would really crave carbs, like certain, especially as a woman, right? I have like, you know, like obviously hormonal things that happen once a month. Sure. And around my hormone times, I would just be like, oh my gosh, like I was just craving carbs like crazy. Right. And so then I started to kind of like do like the cheat and then go right back onto it and then cheat and then go right back onto it like once a month. So it was kind of helping, but then I also felt like, you know, obviously, as you know, it takes you a while to kind of get back into that weight loss mode, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, I would cheat and then it would be like no loss for 2 weeks. And then I'd start to lose on the third week. And then by the fourth week, I already was back on cheating mode, you know?
Right.
So I wasn't really losing anymore. And then I just totally fell off the wagon again. And then like maybe 2 weeks after that, like, right. Like, I think it had been like 2 months after I had kind of been cheating. I went to the doctor for, a knee injury that I had. And the doctor was like, oh my God, your triglycerides are like sky high, like this, like your cholesterol's high. What are you doing? And I was like, I've been doing keto. And they're like, you've got to like cut down on like the high fat. And I'm like, fuck me. And of course, now I've been seeing a lot of your videos where it like talks about like how, which things are like the ones that you should be staying away from and how, you know, all of this. And so I think just out in the world right now, there's just so many competing things about nutrition.
100%.
So, you know, I honestly, like, I think, kind of, yeah, that's the good and the bad for me. I was just on it. I'm honestly really scared. I'm the, obviously my daughter's only caretaker. And so I have to take care of me. And so I was like, oh my God, I gotta try to be better about this. You know?
Yeah, I gotta want to live a long, full life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I stopped the keto. But I still try to do like moderate, like, you know, I don't, before I used to, you know, be a traditional Mexican and eat tortillas with like every meal, you know, that's just a very traditional thing. I stopped eating tortillas. You know, this morning though, I had like a burrito with like scrambled eggs. It's fine. But I try to like consume my carbs in the morning so that I can kind of get rid of them throughout the day. And really just eating more veggies and things like that. And just trying to eat a little bit more balanced. But, I found a book, by the way, that I don't know if you've heard about it. It's called Intuitive Eating.
No.
And it's really great. And it talks about getting rid of the diet mentality. And honestly, since I've been kind of following this intuitive eating thing, and it just, it really just talks about, you know, how the whole diet, mentality is really what's making us crave what we don't need, you know? And so it talks more about appreciating the foods when you are having them, right? If I'm going to have a carb, really enjoy that carb, you know?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
if I'm going to have that like baked potato, really enjoy that. And, you know, eat it until you're like satisfied and then stop. And so, you know, really just kind of focusing on that. And I've lost like 20 pounds. So I've been doing really good.
Wow.
And
it's without thinking about it. It's like,
without thinking about it. So, you know, I think whatever works for anybody, you know, everyone, does keto work? Absolutely. Was it for me? I think yes and no. You know, I like love the way I felt with it.
Right.
Love the energy. But I think I also was doing a lot more of like the dirty keto, you know, like every now and then I'd like, you know, stop by and get like a double-double from In-N-Out and like with like extra cheese and like,
right,
I just not being healthy about it either, you
right.
know? So I think that also didn't help, you know?
Totally. Well, and I'm not here to convince you. I actually totally agree. I don't think keto's for everyone. I also think that like, it's such a broad, like you can be super unhealthy on keto.
Totally.
You can gain weight on keto. You can lose weight from other things. Like, I think one of the cool things about keto for me, just my part of my journey, is kind of almost like what you said. Like, one thing about keto is that it will teach you, like, it will make you think different about carbs. Like, you just become more aware of how, like, everything has carbs in it. You know, you just become aware of that. I definitely think that there's the medical community is slowly starting to catch up. I think that, like, the word keto might even go away, but this idea of getting rid of some of the flour and sugar that we eat every day is probably a good thing for anybody, at least in the amount that it's generally consumed here in America and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
But I was just kind of curious, like, your journey on it. I occasionally see you make meals on your stories and stuff, and I'm like, that looks very keto to me, you know, like meat totally. And peppers, you know, and like I catch that stuff, you know. And so, yeah, I totally agree. I like this intuitive eating thing. I talk about this a lot across the different ways that I communicate with people, that like the demonization of food, like I hate diet culture. It's yes. one of the things that I'm like, I want to talk about with this podcast and bring to light a lot, is that I do not like diet culture. My cookbook has no discussion of like diet or weight loss or meal plans, or it's just right. good food. That's why I like even wanted so to good. Call it. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to call it New Keto. Like, it's not like this like fad diet book. It's not. Yeah. And that's very like by design, because I'm with you. Like, keto food can just be like regular food that's really delicious. Like, I'm not a big yeah. fan of like foods trying to be foods. Like, I don't really like, there's no like keto pizza in that book or whatever, if that makes sense. It's right. like, I just think like whole like vegetables and meat and a good sauce, like you can make a really good meal and it sort of happens to be keto, but it's not really diet food. It's just like right. good food. Yeah. And so that kind of aligns a little bit. Like certainly there's a little bit more structure around like low carb than just intuitive, but we're not that far apart, you know, in that yeah. sense. I yeah. think like food is not the enemy. And a lot of no. diet culture teaches that, like, don't eat this, don't eat that. You have to count these points and these amount of calories, and like you're in this food prison. And then the second you leave that prison, it's fucking on. Like, I want all the cakes and pies, and I think it's really detrimental. That's why we get through these like these cycles, these yo-yo dieting, yeah. as we hear. People blame the diet, but truthfully, it's not any diet's fault. Like, you can lose weight as a vegan, you can lose weight as keto.
Exactly.
But, like, if you come off of it and you eat 5,000 calories of donuts like the next day, like, yeah, you're gonna gain the weight back, you know. And I do. I'm not criticizing everyone. I've been there. You know,
totally.
So I was just kind of curious your journey, because I see some of the food you make. But you own a bakery. Like, if you were able to do that and be keto, I would worship you. Like, there's no way. Like, the only reason there's I can no get way. Away with there's no red. Way. Yeah, like even when I do my like private event stuff, and if it's not a keto client, like I'm still eating what I'm cooking. Like, there's yeah. no way.
Yeah.
I can't be around like regular food and not like, you know, fortunately, like my job is now writing keto recipes, and therefore, I stay keto. No, I do actually, for me, I really do believe it. I just mean like from like the sake of willpower. I don't have that. Like, if something's delicious, like I want all of it, you know. Yeah. I want it stuff.
Well, but you know, the difference too, though, is like when, like now, you know, I've been doing the bakery thing since June of last year, and I'm kind of over it already.
By the way, like, great timing, like, way to open a restaurant in June of 2020.
Oh, how exciting!
Congratulations. I mean, if you're over it, give yourself some grace, because you're allowed to be, because damn, like this has been a challenging year.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
But also, you have so much love to give, so I hope you keep going.
Yeah. You know, it is what it is. It is what it is. But, you know, I think like, you know, if you work in a pizza shop, you're not going to want to eat pizza for dinner. You know, it's just, it's true. Kind of the way that the restaurant industry works, you know? So, I mean, yes, I own a bakery, but, you know, it's like, I'm not going to sit here and lie and be like, oh, I never eat my pastries. But, you know, it's like very few and far between now. I probably eat like one every like 3 weeks now. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
really?
Because I'm like, oh, that sounds good today or something, you know, or, but yeah, it's, you know, it is what it is.
Interesting. Interesting.
I love it.
Very interesting. Well, stay in touch about your food journey, just because like the food nerd in me is just like really interesting to learn about different diets and how they work for different people. So I'm intrigued. Yeah. I like this idea of intuitive, because like I talk about this all the time. I think I've said this on here and certainly on Instagram. Like I love when I cook with like butternut squash or carrots or something that's not keto, and like my DMs blow up with people like, that's not keto. And then I go to their page and it's like, you know, they're eating like these powders and bars with like 400 ingredients in them just because they say the word keto on it. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, there's something mixed up in diet culture. Like we're like fed this idea that like these companies make all this money off products and ways to keep feeding us, pun intended, like feeding us content and stuff to put in our face that's like part of this diet culture. When at the end of the day, like we should just be eating like meat, fish and veggies and like good stuff, you know?
Exactly. Good so whole ingredients. I mean, yeah. The biggest conversation that I want to finish off with you, if it's all right, is about sugar. You talked about this a lot, and how sugar, a lot of people don't realize that sugars have carbs, you know, it is a carb. And so, how many of our diets include these diet sugars and how bad they are for our organism. So if you can have a naturally sugared carrot, then that's so much better than, you know, putting a ton of saccharin in your body or whatever it is. You know, there are better things for your body, that, you know, better carbs. And yeah. I think if you can choose, whole sources of food, then that's always going to be so much better.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think a piece of fruit or sweet potato is evil, rethink
a
little bit.
There's a problem.
Yeah, there's a problem. I love it. Well, I'm glad. This was such a cool discussion. Hope to have you back sometime soon. Guys, make sure that you grab a copy of Claudia's book. It's really fantastic. I've had it for a long time. I love it so much. And Claudia, where can our friends find more of you if they want to follow your journey?
Yeah, Chef Claudia Sandoval on Instagram, Chef Claudia S on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. You can go to my website, Chef Claudia Sandoval. And of course, if you want to order some carby treats, you can go to elcochidorado.com.
Say that one more time. Your audio broke up, and I want to make sure they can hear that.
Yeah. Go to elcochidorado.com.
Beautiful. Guys, oh, and what's your Food Network show that just came out?
Oh, yeah. Easter Basket Challenge. Easter Basket Challenge.
Easter Basket
Challenge. It's available on Food Network or Discovery Plus.
Cool. Amazing. Well, thank you, Claudia. You guys, please join me right after this. I'm going to just talk to you guys. I'm going to kick her out of the room and we're going to talk all kinds of shit about her right after this at my Patreon, patreon.com/chefmichael. It's members only, so it's going to get spicy in there. Join me over there. Of course, get Claudia's book, get my book, shameless plug. New Keto Cooking is also anywhere books are sold. If you want really just a beautiful whole food approach to keto food, not diet-y food. yes, please make sure you're following Claudia. She's epic. I love what you're doing, girl. Keep doing it. Keep sharing your light and your energy. I'm really rooting you on. So I love watching everything that you're doing. So thank you so much for being here. And thank you so much to our sponsor, Redmond Salt, for providing support for this podcast. Go to redmond.life and get yourself some of their awesome sea salts with over 65 trace minerals. Use the discount code ChefMichael for 15% off. I will see you guys after this at the bonus episode. And if you want more information, go to chefmichael.com/podcast. That's chef-michael.com, because some asshole owns chefmichael.com. I love you guys so much, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.